a slippery slope. Jeremy Corbyn implored people to stand up for the right to protest. Stand up for the right to have your voice heard.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajeem. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما ويحذركم الله نفسه
of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah hath power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time, and Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Army says it has launched new retaliatory drone strikes on Jizan Airport and a major military airbase in Saudi Arabia. Iran's nuclear chief says that the Islamic Republic is exporting its indigenous radiopharmaceuticals to several countries. Brazil reports more than 2,600 corona-related deaths. Several other Latin American states witness a new wave of infections. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behruz Ajabek. Good to have you with us. Now, starting with Yemen, the army says it's carried out fresh drone strikes successfully, hitting targets in southern Saudi Arabia. Army spokesman Yahya Saria says the strikes targeted military hangars at the Jizan Airport and King Khalid Air Base near the city of Khamis Mashait. Two Qassam 2K drones were used in the operation in response to the Saudi aggression and continued siege of Yemen. Meantime, the Saudi-led coalition said it intercepted and destroyed a Yemeni explosives-laden drone heading for Khamis Mashait. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war on Yemen in 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. Yemeni forces are pushing ahead with a retaliatory strike to force Riyadh to end the aggression and blockade on the impoverished country. Correspondent Sana Abdullatif al-Washali says that the Yemeni army aims to push Saudi Arabia toward a political solution to the long-running conflict.
The Yemeni army is pressing ahead with its operations and retaliatory attacks against Saudi facilities to push Saudi Arabia to move toward a political solution to stop its siege and to stop its war against the Yemeni people. The Yemeni army is also pressing ahead with its operations on the ground against Marib City, which is the last stronghold of Saudi Arabia and northern Yemen. The Yemeni army is pressing ahead with its operations to push Saudi Arabia to stop its war, to move toward a political solution, to end the suffering of millions of Yemeni people. The siege is killing tens of thousands of Yemenis, according to officials here in Sana'a. The siege caused a harsh shortage of fuel, and most of the health facilities have stopped providing health services to civilians, including women and the children, infants, and breastfeeding women.
The United Nations says it is yet to receive proof of life for Sheikha Latifa, the daughter of Dubai's ruler. In our news review program, my colleague has discussed that issue with our guest.
The UN Human Rights Office says it is still waiting for proof of life for Sheikha Latifa, daughter of Dubai's ruler. Spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Marta Hurtada, said the UN wants clear, compelling evidence the princess is still alive. In a video message published back in mid-February, the princess had said that she was being held hostage and fears for her life. Latifa had tried to escape the country in 2018, but was captured and returned back to the United Arab Emirates. UN spokeswoman also said the senior officials have sought a meeting with the UAE ambassador in Geneva on this issue. She said they are also planning to raise the case of Latifa's older sister, Shamsa, who was kidnapped in broad daylight in Cambridge at the age of 18 and has not been seen in public ever since. And now joining us for the program is Kevin Barrett, author, Middle East affairs expert out of Madison, Wisconsin, and Zafar Bangesh, director at the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, joining us out of Toronto. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll start with you, Mr. Zafar Bangesh. I hope you're safe and doing well. Your initial thoughts on this story.
Obviously, the UAE government appears to be dragging its feet over this issue because the princess, Sheikha Latifa, has not been seen since she was captured in 2018. She had actually made her escape from Dubai to Oman, and then from there she took a water launch and she was trying to escape to India. And near the coast of India, Indian commandos raided that boat, and she was captured and handed over to the UAE. And some of the messages that she had sent out previously from her captivity, she said that she's being kept like a prisoner. There are no, or the windows are shut in her house. And I suspect that perhaps the UN has more than it is letting out today. Perhaps it has information that Sheikha Latifa might even have been killed. Unfortunately, these Arabian rulers are pretty ruthless. They themselves do all kinds of terrible things, but when their daughters or sisters, etc., do something that they don't like, then they become extremely ruthless. So I'm afraid there could be really, really serious concerns for her life, as well as that of her sister, Sheikha Shamsa, who, as you mentioned, she was kidnapped from the streets of Cambridge in England. And as you know, even the British Home Secretary, Dominic Raab, has expressed concerns about the safety and well-being of Sheikha Latifa.
Thank you, Mr. Kevin Barrett. I'd like to welcome you to the program, sir. Hope you're doing well out there in Madison, Wisconsin. Your initial thoughts on this? I mean, when I hear about someone getting kidnapped in broad daylight in Cambridge, and there's no true condemnation, no real sanctions, you think about the allegations that the Russians were responsible for that double agent and his daughter that were poisoning the streets in the UK. There were sanctions, there was expulsions of diplomats. You remember the fiasco that came behind that. And it's just as funny how the application of the law is so selective sometimes. Your thoughts on this?
No, I'm sorry, the connection is bad, so you're fading in and out. I could only hear a little bit of that. But from what I heard, I understood that you're referring to this double standard in which, you know, international law supposedly, you know, only applies to certain people and not to others. And these puppet rulers seem to be among the people who are protected and untouchable. And they get away with murder, literally, as we know from the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mr. Bonesaw. And it seems that the Emir of Dubai is not much better. Princess Latifa, when she was escaping, apparently was saying that she had been appalled by her knowledge of murders by her father. And you know, she's not the only daughter to have this problem, of course, and even one of his wives has essentially fled him. So, I guess people who are given this kind of absolute power in these incredibly corrupt colonial systems are likely to become absolutely corrupt. And really, the best way to deal with this in the long run is to change the system in these places. These desert puppets, the people that were prophesied in the Hadith literature, who would be barefoot, desert, uncouth, uncultured Bedouins who would be building tall buildings and vying with each other and building tall buildings in the last days. These people are just kind of the scum of the earth, frankly. And yet they have incredible power. They're protected by the world's biggest imperial powers in New York, Washington, and London. And meanwhile, the human rights organizations in New York, Washington, and London make noise about it, but they can't do anything about it, which just goes to show how corrupt and hypocritical the West really is.
That was a great analogy there, too, by the way. Thank you both, gentlemen. Time has gotten the better of us. Thanks, and do stay safe, both of you. Kevin Barrett there, Middle East Affairs expert, joining us from Madison, Wisconsin, and Mr. Zafar Bangesh, director at the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, joining us out of Canada. That's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Welcome back. Moving on with the rest of this news broadcast, the head of the Nuclear Energy Organization of Iran says that the country has become a manufacturer and exporter of radiopharmaceuticals. Ali Akbar Salehi described, he described the manufacturing of medical facilities as one of Iran's main achievements in the field of nuclear technology. He made that remarks on the occasion of Iran's National Day for Peaceful Nuclear Energy. Tehran sees nuclear technology as vital for its medical science. Dr. Saleh noted that Iran's nuclear organization has provided a centrifuge for the production of the national COVID vaccine, Barakat, and finalized another one, which is dedicated to a blood bank. Another component also produced in Iran, vital for teeth implant and body repair, is titanium. Iran is a major exporter of medicinal radio compounds to India, Lebanon, Iraq, and a number of European countries. Meantime, the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran has reported an incident at the country's Natanz uranium enrichment plant. Behrouz Kamalvandi, who is the spokesman of the organization, says the incident affected part of the electricity distribution network there. It caused no casualties or contamination and is being investigated. The incident came a day after Iran started up several cascades of advanced centrifuges in that facility. Last year, a blast hit a centrifuge assembly line at Natanz, which Iran described as an act of sabotage. Iranian nuclear chief Ali Akbar Salehi then blamed the explosion on the enemy. Iran has confirmed more than 19,600 new COVID-19 infections as the country is grappling with a fourth wave of the pandemic. Saturday marks the fourth straight day that new infections have been around 20,000. The health ministry has confirmed 200 new COVID-related deaths. The pandemic is in one of its deadliest phases since it hit Iran. The uptick is blamed on more contagious strains of the virus and New Year travels. This has prompted the government to enforce a 10-day lockdown in 80% of Iranian cities.
As the fourth wave of the coronavirus hits Iran, the country goes under another nationwide lockdown. From Saturday on, for at least 10 days, travel to and from high-risk cities will be banned, and non-essential businesses have to roll down their shutters. Schools, entertainment centers, and all public places will also be closed. Officials have avoided a total lockdown in Tehran, arguing that the capital city accommodates major national and international activities. The closures come amid a new wave of infections across Iran, which is believed to be the UK variant of COVID-19. Entering the country from neighboring Iraq.
The first reason why our hospitals are once again overwhelmed with COVID-19 patients is the fact that British variant of the virus slipped into our country through our Khuzestan and Iran borders with Iraq. Now we are unfortunately faced with a fourth wave of the pandemic.
Authorities blamed the new spike on the two-week traveling spree during the Persian New Year holidays, which started on March 21st. The number of confirmed coronavirus cases in Iran has passed the 2 million mark, and the total fatalities have surpassed 64,000.
Any lockdown definitely ensures my health, and I welcome the restrictive measures. But on the other hand, I am losing a significant portion of my income as I am self-employed, and if I close my business, I will not make money.
The government has promised to provide the low-income strata of society with aid packages, but I personally, as a taxi driver, have received nothing. Aside from this, the government should put us taxi drivers among the first to receive COVID injections, as we are prone to infection from passengers.
Vaccination of the most vulnerable groups of the society is underway in Iran with Russian-made Sputnik V vaccine. But the country is yet to launch a nationwide vaccination program. The government hopes to kickstart mass inoculation in 2 months, using its own homegrown jabs.
While vaccines have also come in the ring to join the fight against COVID-19, the virus is still hard to knock out. Health officials advise everyone to take the new restrictions seriously. As they say, chances of survival are much lower for those who get infected with the UK variant of the coronavirus. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Now, this is while Latin America remains one of the hottest spots of the coronavirus pandemic, Brazil being the worst-hit nation in that region. The country recorded 72,000 new infections Saturday, as well as 2,600 deaths. That puts its total infection tally at 13.4 million and the deaths at over 350,000. This is the second worst globally after the U.S. Mexico also reported 2,200 new COVID deaths, one of its biggest one-day tolls. Its total fatalities topped 209,000. In Argentina, authorities tightened restriction movements after a record number of daily infections at over 19,000. The country has confirmed over 2.5 million cases and 57,000 deaths. A new wave of infections has hit Ecuador, which has so far recorded some 343,000 cases and 17,000 fatalities. Turkish and Ukrainian presidents have sat for talks on regional and international issues, as well as ways to expand mutual cooperation in different sectors. Now, that meeting is held amid rising tensions between Russia and Ukraine. Rashan Saglar reports.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky held talks with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Istanbul. The visit comes amid tensions between Kiev and Moscow over Ukraine's eastern Donbas region. Meanwhile, Russia bulked up its military presence on Ukraine's eastern border, threatening military action. During the meeting, the two presidents spoke about ways of cooperation in different sectors and strengthening ties between the two countries, including free trade, tourism, and sports. Following the meeting, which was also attended by ministers from both sides, a number of agreements were signed.
Turkey strongly defends the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. We hope that the escalation in eastern Ukraine will come to an end and the conflict will be resolved through dialogue based on the Minsk agreement.
The United States, after informing Turkey as per the Montreux Convention, sent two warships through Turkish straits towards the Black Sea. Turkish Foreign Ministry said the warships will stay in the Black Sea until May 4.
The tension between Russia and Ukraine is increasing every minute. Ukraine is waiting for support from the EU and the US. But Russia has clearly expressed that Crimea is its red line and will not give it to Ukraine. I think this visit is aimed at sorting things out. Ukraine wants to make sure that Turkey is on its side, especially after the phone call between Turkish and Russian presidents.
Late on Friday, Russian President Vladimir Putin discussed with his Turkish counterpart over the phone the Ukraine crisis and the presence of U.S. warships in the Black Sea. Turkish president assured that Ankara's cooperation with Ukraine does not mean it is against Russia. Analysts believe Turkey is trying to play the role of peacemaker in the region without taking sides. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Egypt and Sudan have rejected a proposal by Ethiopia to share data on a contentious dam on the Blue Nile. Cairo and Khartoum have called for a legally binding agreement over the operations in the structure dubbed as the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam. Ethiopia says the project is key to its economic development and power generation. Cairo and Khartoum, however, fear that the dam could threaten their own water flows. On Sunday, the Democratic Republic of the Congo hosted trilateral talks between Ethiopia, Egypt, and Sudan to resolve the dispute. The talks ended without a breakthrough, Ethiopia saying it will not be deterred from filling water at the mega dam. Activist and political commentator Netva Freeman joined us earlier with a breakdown of the controversy surrounding the megadam in Ethiopia. Here's what he had to say.
And we're talking about a geopolitical situation that's very tense, and in the negotiations that broke down, one of the sticking points was that, and I think it's a big one, was that Sudan and Egypt wanted the U.S. and the EU to be part of the mediation of the negotiations, and that was one of the things the Ethiopia rejected, and that should be understandably so. And I don't know why, you know, well, I know why they would invite them to be that, is because basically Sudan and Egypt are neocolonial, they're proxies for neocolonialism, U.S. and Western neocolonialism, and Ethiopia is trying to embark on a path towards self-reliance and independence, self-determination independence. This could be possible if, in fact, they were allowed for example, the African Union to leave the negotiations and keep out the West, which they, you know, which of course is also trying to engage in putting a wedge and turning back Ethiopia's track onto the road to self-determination.
Huge blazes continue to rage across Nepal as the tiny South Asian country is battling its worst wildfires in almost a decade. At least five people have died while trying to put out the fires that are burning at 60 places of Nepal's 77 administrative districts. Firefighters are working to bring the flames under control. The infernos have prompted schools across the Himalayan nation to close after air quality reached its hazardous level. More than 2,700 wildfires have been reported in Nepal since November, 14 times higher than the same period last year. Forest fires often erupt in Nepal during the January-May dry season. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth,
Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The limelight.
The House Ethics Committee on Friday, 9th of April, announced it will open an investigation into the Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz amid a widening scandal involving allegations related to sex trafficking. In a statement, the committee said it was aware of the public allegations that Matt Gaetz may have engaged in sexual misconduct and or illicit drug use, shared inappropriate images or videos on the House of Representatives floor, misused state identification records, converted campaign funds to personal use, and or accepted a bribe, improper gratuity, or impermissible gift in violation of House rules, laws, or other standards of conduct. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnists Lauren Gambino and Adam Gabbat. The piece is titled, Republican Matt Gaetz Faces Calls to Resign from Members of His Own Party. House of Representatives Ethics Committee on Friday, 9th of April, announced it will open an investigation into the Republican Congressman Matt Gaetz amid a widening scandal involving allegations related to sex trafficking. In a statement, the committee said it was aware of the public allegations that Matt Gaetz may have engaged in sexual misconduct and or illicit drug use, shared inappropriate images or videos on the House floor, misused state identification records, converted campaign funds to personal use, and or accepted a bribe, improper gratuity, or impermissible gift in violation of House rules, laws, or other standards of conduct. Since the New York Times reported that Matt Gaetz, a close ally of former President Donald Trump, was under investigation by the Department of Justice over whether he had a sexual relationship with a 17-year-old teenager, the 38-year-old Florida congressman has faced a torrent of accusations ranging from alleged sexual misconduct to accusations of impropriety. Matt Gaetz has forcefully denied all the allegations against him. He is also now facing calls to resign from a member of his own party. Adam Kinzinger, a Republican from Illinois, wrote, Matt Gaetz needs to resign in a tweet posted on Thursday, linking to a Daily Beast article which claims Gaetz paid $900 to an accused sex trafficker. The congressman has refused to step down, despite calls from Democrats, but will face renewed scrutiny after Adam Kinzinger became the first prominent member of the Republican Party to also demand that Matt Gaetz should resign. The Daily Beast reported that Matt Gaetz sent Joel Greenberg, a friend who is accused of crimes including sex trafficking, a 17-year-old teenage girl, and is said to be negotiating a plea deal with prosecutors, a payment of $900 over Venmo in May of 2018. The next day, according to the Daily Beast, Greenberg used the same app to send payments totaling $900 to three young women, Greenberg captioned the payments to the women as tuition, school, and school. After the Daily Beast approached Matt Gaetz for comment, he responded through a public relations firm. Matt Gaetz responded by saying, "The rumors, gossip, and self-serving misstatements of others will be addressed in due course by my legal team." Thursday, 8th of April, lawyers said Joel Greenberg was planning to strike a plea deal with prosecutors. Joel Greenberg faces charges including one count of sex trafficking involving a 17-year-old teenage girl, stalking, and wire fraud. NBC News reported that prosecutors are examining Matt Gaetz and Joel Greenberg's relationship and whether they used the internet to search for women they could pay for sex. Also under investigation is whether Matt Gaetz paid women to travel to the Bahamas, according to NBC News. Over the past 2 weeks, numerous reports have emerged of Matt Gaetz's dubious behavior. CNN reported that Matt Gaetz, sometimes on the floor of the House of Representatives, showed other lawmakers pictures of women, while allegations reemerged that Gaetz had created a game with a point-scoring system for fellow politicians. Gaetz was elected to the House of Representatives in 2016, the same year that Donald Trump was elected president, and quickly tied his fortunes to that of Donald Trump. He became one of Donald Trump's stoutest defenders, making frequent appearances on Fox News Channel, and in 2018, Matt Gaetz was one of 18 House Republicans who nominated Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize. In January, Matt Gaetz traveled to Wyoming to hold a rally against Liz Cheney, one of the state's U.S. senators, due to her perceived disloyalty to Donald Trump. Matt Gaetz may have wanted something from Donald Trump in return. This week, the New York Times revealed that in the last days of Donald Trump's presidency, Matt Gaetz asked the White House for blanket preemptive pardons for himself and unidentified congressional allies for any crimes they may have committed.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
communique.
Iran and China have signed a 25-year strategic partnership, which marks an extraordinary milestone in the relationship between the two nations. So what exactly is in this roadmap? What does it mean for the two nations? What does it mean for the world? And how is this deal being perceived by rivals such as the United States? Let's take a closer look. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. Officially dubbed the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership, Iran and China finally inked the 25-year roadmap in Tehran on March 27, 2021, with the foreign ministers of both countries at the ceremony. Iran's foreign minister, Javad Zarif, alongside China's Wang Yi, heralded China as being a friend for difficult times and underscored the importance of the friendship between the two countries. Now, the origins of this deal go back to 2016, when Iran's President Rouhani and China's President Xi Jinping began talks about increasing partnership between the two ancient civilizations who've enjoyed bilateral ties for 2,000 years. It's worth pointing out that this strategic partnership between China and Iran is not a clear-cut treaty of sorts like some people imagine, but more of a broader roadmap for the next 25 years, which seeks to strengthen cooperation between the two nations and their economies, their energy sectors, military, their international relations, and also in the fields of education, culture, tourism, and much more. It's quite a remarkable step in beefing up ties between the two countries, and both nations stand to benefit greatly from this strategic partnership. China will invest heavily in Iran's infrastructure, specifically in its manufacturing sector, communications, transportation, and in exchange, Iran will provide a steady supply of oil. It's important to note that China is Iran's largest trading partner. China is also the world's largest importer of oil, surpassing the United States in 2017. Although China leads the world in investments in clean energy and renewables, its enormous energy requirements mean that it needs a steady supply of crude. And that's exactly what Iran can provide. What makes this equally advantageous for Iran is the fact that Iran can not only offload the oil that it produces, but also get something directly in exchange for it in the form of direct investments and development of its infrastructure. Remember, Iran is the world's fourth largest producer of oil and has been cut off from the global market due to United States sanctions. Both its banking sector and its energy sector have been placed under embargo, making it difficult to not only sell the oil, but also engage in trade and finance, even if one were able to sell it in the first place. This partnership with China provides an alternate avenue for Iran to secure the development of its infrastructure while also providing China with a way to secure its demand for oil. It's a crucial step forward in rebuffing the alliance between the two powers and also an important milestone in the realm of international relations and Asia's geopolitical standing. Now, while some reports quote a figure of around $400 billion being invested by China in Iran, this appears to stem from a draft that appeared in the New York Times in 2020. That's not to say that it's not necessarily true. As a matter of fact, it doesn't seem an unlikely endeavor over the course of 25 years. But just to say that the partnership is more of a roadmap that expands investment, research and development, and mutual cooperation in a large number of fields. And it's not just about a one-time sum or a one-time figure. It's a much bigger deal than that. This partnership will see Iran integrated into China's Belt and Road Initiative, which China officially announced and adopted in 2013 as part of its foreign policy. The Belt and Road Initiative is essentially a revival of the Silk Road. This is the infamous network of trade routes that connected East and West, running all the way from China to Syria to Greece. These trade routes were not just by land, but also maritime. And China's Belt and Road Initiative seeks to bring about a modern adaptation of the ancient Silk Road, with maritime and land bridges going all the way from East Asia to West Asia to Africa to Europe. The United States, 2 months into Joe Biden's presidency, still has not rejoined the Iran nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. This agreement from 2015, which sought to limit Iran's nuclear program in exchange for unfreezing of assets and sanctions relief, was torn up by Donald Trump, who left the agreement in 2018. Now, the reimposition of sanctions in an attempt to isolate Iran on the international stage has brought on huge amounts of suffering, austerity, and anguish. Foreign investments, trade, commerce, finance, and international developmental projects have been quashed by the United States' efforts to malign Iran. During this time, however, Iran has found the ability to develop its own vaccines, its own defense industry, to innovate and make do with little and learn how to survive. The ingenuity of the Iranian people, combined with the willingness of other maligned countries like Syria, China, Russia, Venezuela, to cooperate with each other, has led to a shift in the balance of power. The United States and its aggression has created new realignments that are now seeing these countries actually grow stronger and create new opportunities, which might not have presented themselves otherwise. Not to take away, of course, from the brutality of sanctions, which are considered by many to be akin to siege warfare, but all this is to say that there is definitely a silver lining to be found here. The United States and its European allies, in trying to isolate and divide Iran and others, have actually ended up bringing these countries closer together and reinforcing their alliances. The significance of this strategic partnership between Iran and China is not only economically beneficial, but also a seismic shift in geopolitical terms. Joining me from Bangkok is author and journalist Pepe Escobar, editor-at-large for the Asia Times. Thanks for taking the time, Pepe. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you. My pleasure. Thank you.
So, Pepe, you know, China has signed some of these strategic partnerships with other countries in the past as part of its general foreign policy and diplomacy. What makes this one with Iran so special? Why does this one stand out in particular?
Well, this is the solidification via a deal that was quoted as a roadmap, in fact, including by Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif, that it's the Belt and Road Initiative as applied to Southwest Asia. That's why it's so important. It's groundbreaking. I was writing about this only a few hours ago. That is as important in historical terms as the very close relationship between the China and Iran, Persia at the time, civilizations during the Yuan dynasty in the 13th century. They are back as they were at the time, with a very, very close relationship. And this has been in the making for quite a while, of course. There was a lot of back and forth, diplomatic meetings, high-level meetings. It is a roadmap. Of course, we don't have details. Because it's very long-term. It's a 25-year-long meeting, a deal, including everything in terms of trade, connectivity, and investment to how much China is going to get in terms of oil and gas from Iran and investing in the Iranian energy system as well. It's very comprehensive, of course, so the details will come up a little by little, of course. I heard there is some resistance inside Iran about it, which is, of course, considering the magnitude of this deal, it's perfectly understandable. But in terms of being a win-win deal, it's absolutely perfect for the Iranian economy in the long run, and in terms of securing a problem of national security for China, which is their supply of energy. So obviously, you can imagine how this was received in the Belt Road, of course. what I heard is the usual link to the maximum pressure campaign. To some so-called analysts in the Belt Road that they think that they know anything about Iran, when in fact they don't, saying that now we lost Iran for good. But that's a joke. We cannot take these people seriously, obviously. The most important thing is that there are so many processes that will be driven or influenced by this deal, in terms of the whole connectivity of Southwest Asia to Belt and Road, to the International Transportation Corridor, the INSTT, to the Russian vision of Greater Eurasia, that were, you know, it's still too early for us to imagine the repercussions all over Southwest Asia of what is, in fact, a major game-changing strategic partnership.
And you know, regarding the timing of this deal, we just had these talks in Alaska, and you know, you wrote in the Asia Times that the timing of this deal is quite historic. Can you elaborate on that for us?
Absolutely. The timing was a thing of beauty, in fact. And I have been following everything that has been happening, even before Alaska, starting with the virtual Quad meeting. So I wrote four columns in sequence. They are completely interlinked. And we didn't know, in fact, that after the end of the 1E Sergei Lavrov meeting in Guilin, which was early in the week, where they were discussing details of the Russia-China strategic partnership, considering what had happened in Alaska. And obviously before that, the Quad meeting. We didn't know that the China-Iran strategic partnership deal would be signed only a few days later, on a Saturday. So obviously, the timing was kept extremely secret by Wang Yi himself, of course, and by the Iranian leadership. So it all came together, because this involves, most of all, and this is something that it's never enough to stress to an international audience, in fact, the only three sovereigns in the planet right now are Russia, China, and Iran. I'm talking about major powers or near major powers. We could include Cuba, which is a sovereign in itself, in an extraordinary story. But the breadth and reach of Cuba, you cannot compare to Russia, China, or even Iran in terms of areas of influence. So these are the three major sovereign powers in the world that not by accident are listed as threats to the U.S. in the U.S. national security strategy. And the fact that in only 2 weeks, you have them getting closer and closer via strategic partnerships in the case of Russia, China, and then in the case of China and Iran. That's what makes it really a game-changing moment in 21st century politics. Anything that happens from now on, it will never, the previous status quo is dead, completely. Now, the declining hegemon, as we know it, will have to deal with this interconnection between Russia, Iran, and China. And that's why the whole thing now is a completely different ballgame.
So, you know, the United States, they've been trying to isolate Iran for decades now on the international stage. How does this deal play into the context of sanctions, of the JCPOA, which the United States still hasn't re-entered?
Well, it is a game changer as well, because now it's clear, including for the other members of the JCPOA, that Russia and China back Iran 110%. And on top of it, there is a strategic partnership involved in terms of China's support. And sooner rather than later, we're going to have a Russian strategic support as well, because in fact, members of the Iranian parliament are already talking about a Russia-Iran strategic partnership deal, which will be sealed eventually, in the short term, in fact. And obviously, within the P5 plus one part of the JCPOA, we know since Vienna in 2015, I was there covering it at the time, that Russia and China support the Iranian position. This is even more solidified now. We know that Europeans are dying for this thing to restart, and they know that the only realistic way for JCPOA to be back is if we are back to what was decided in Vienna in 2015. So, and that leaves once again the isolated exceptionals, and we don't know. In fact, they don't. This is according to. I talk about this with my sources in the Beltway virtually every week. They all tell me the same thing. This administration has no idea what to do about the JCPOA. They don't have a policy. They don't have a vision. And of course, they don't have a strategy. Their strategy will be, okay, let's raise the pressure on Iran a little bit. We impose a few extra conditions, and then maybe we'll go back to JCPOA, and maybe we'll alleviate some of the sanctions. Well, this is not diplomacy. This is not foreign policy, as we know. But this is where we're at the moment. So, okay, we heard a few rumbles these past few days that they would be willing to, let's alleviate some sanctions to the tune of $20 billion. in the short to medium term. But this is just a rumor. There's not a proposition on the table yet.
So, I mean, do you expect Iran to be able to bypass, so to speak, U.S. sanctions in a sense, because now they have a way to offload some of their oil output with China and get something in return for that? Is that an accurate assessment?
Well, bypassing U.S. sanctions is an extremely complicated process for the firms who are doing it. If they are Iranian firms, if they are multinational companies, if they are European firms with multinational connections, even if they are Chinese firms, if you use the U.S. dollar, you are in big trouble. If you bypass the U.S. dollar, if you use some sort of trading mechanism bypassing the U.S. dollar, or if you deal in your own currencies, that's a completely different story. If you use barter, if you are paid in anything apart from U.S. dollars, no problem. This is something that has been happening for quite a while, right? So this is the way to go, I would say. In terms of using SWIFT, again, which is the heart of the matter, in terms of sanctions being, sanctions are basically gone, which is something that is not going to happen because it involves the U.S. Congress as well. So. I don't see any, feasible scenario ahead where Iran would be back or Iranian firms would be back to using SWIFT for transactions with the West. With China is a completely different story because you can use reals, you can use yuan, you can use barter mechanisms, you name it. And now, within the scope of the new strategic deal, there are so many possibilities, right? Which, of course, have been discussed before the signing of the deal.
Pepe Escobar, thank you so much for your time and your brilliant reporting. It's a pleasure having you on.
All right. Okay. Cheers. Bye-bye. Thank you.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
One area that is clearly set to benefit from this partnership with China is Iran's energy sector. Iran is one of the world's largest producers of oil, and its economy and energy needs also rely heavily on oil exports. One of the main staples of the nuclear deal signed in 2015 was to lift the embargo on its oil sector. Following the lifting of sanctions, according to OPEC, oil exports from Iran increased by 1 million barrels within a year and doubled within 2 years. When Donald Trump left the deal in 2018, he reimposed sanctions targeting Iran's oil sector specifically, among its banking sector and others. Now, this new partnership with China provides Iran with an alternative way to export its oil and to get something in return too, oil, in exchange for infrastructure building. China is Iran's largest trading partner. Iran has a lot of oil, and China needs it. China is powerful enough to actually stand up to U.S. sanctions to the point where it's willing to engage with Iran in trade. It's willing to engage with its allies in defiance of the United States. Another example of why a strategic partnership like this is so important, if we look at the destruction brought on by U.S. sanctions, many companies that had been excited to invest in Iran were forced to abandon their projects and leave for fear of being fined, jailed, or sanctioned themselves by the U.S. Treasury. One such company is the Swedish communications giant Ericsson, which sought to develop Iran's 5G network. Now, this project was ultimately abandoned and will now be picked up by China's Huawei. This is, again, a huge advantage of having a partner like China who is not afraid to stand up to U.S. sanctions and can invest in developing the infrastructures of its allies. Now, it's interesting to see the reactions brought on by the announcement of this deal. When asked about it, this is what President Joe Biden had to say.
How concerning is the emerging partnership between China and Iran?
I've been concerned about that for a year.
You can see how the question was framed to begin with, that it's meant to keep pushing this xenophobic propaganda, this fear-mongering about Iran. Are you concerned? The reporter asks, and Biden replies that he is. That's weird. I didn't realize that it's his place to be concerned. Is Joe Biden the president of Iran? Is he the president of China? It's not really his business. And indeed, in the headlines of the Western press, one can also see an explicit admission that U.S. interests are at stake. Instead of analyzing how this strategic partnership can be mutually beneficial for both China and Iran, the mainstream media and the West portray it as a disaster because it weakens U.S. influence, with some pundits even invoking the Bush-era nomenclature and dubbing it the new axis of evil. They can't frame it as two countries engaging in commerce and partnership. No, they have to frame it as a threat because it weakens U.S. influence. But when we talk about weakening U.S. influence, what does that mean exactly? What is U.S. influence? Support for Israel and Saudi Arabia? Illegally occupying Syria and Iraq? Starving people with sanctions? Colonizing them in the name of democracy and then refusing to leave for decades? No one wants that. So maybe a decrease in U.S. influence, and by extension British and European influence, is a good thing. You know, the West has done enough damage to West Asia and the Middle East. So next time you see a headline about U.S. influence being weakened, what they really mean is the United States' ability to sanction Iran, to starve its people and isolate it on the world stage in order to effectuate Washington, D.C.'s foreign policy objectives. Just a few days later, on March 31st, Biden also announced a plan to invest $2.3 trillion into U.S. infrastructure. It felt a lot like he was trying to compensate for the recent announcement by China and Iran. He mentioned China six times in his remarks and actually pointed out correctly that China is out-investing the United States and outdoing them in virtually every sector.
The largest American jobs investment since World War II will create millions of jobs, good-paying jobs, will grow the economy, make us more competitive around the world, promote our national security interests, and put us in a position to win the global competition with China. Clean energy, the competition with China in particular, who doesn't think we have to improve our infrastructure. They know China and other countries are eating our lunch. That's what competition between America and China and the rest of the world is all about.
Now, the only reason the Western media and politicians are making a fuss about the strategic partnership between China and Iran is because they weren't included in it. I mean, just imagine for a second if the United Kingdom or France or Germany had struck a 25-year partnership deal with another country. Would anyone in Western media be talking about this in the same manner? They would pat themselves on the back for being such great diplomats and merchants. But when China and Iran engage in a partnership, they demonize them. Or, for example, when Iran and Venezuela trade fuel and gold with each other, the United States pirates their ships and sells them off. And the United Kingdom freezes Venezuela's assets, their gold in London. This is how Western powers operate. They're a mafia. They say, you either give us a cut or we're going to take it by force. The United States feels threatened by China's growing power. And this is also why Trump, he went on and banned Huawei, or threatened to ban TikTok unless they agree to sell to a U.S. firm. That's not a free and fair market like they claim to uphold. That's trying to crush the competition and make sure that Silicon Valley and American companies, and by extension the national security state, maintain their monopoly over the big tech industry. This Belt and Road Initiative, this revival of the ancient Silk Road, also poses a huge threat to the United States. It's a major point of contention in the Cold War between China and the United States. The Anglo-American way of doing things is to invade, occupy, to kill the local population and steal its resources. Just look at Iraq, just look at Afghanistan, look at Syria, look at the opium wars with China, the CIA and MI6 coup in Iran. The people in Asia and Africa and Latin America, they know all too well how Western imperialism corrupts and destroys their countries. The Chinese way of doing things is different. China is not sending its armies to invade the Middle East. China is not putting 800 military bases across the globe. China is seeking to engage with other countries based on mutual respect. You know, people talk about China colonizing other countries because it enters into strategic partnerships with them. Okay, well, hold on a second. I didn't see any Chinese bases in Syria stealing oil or occupying Iraq for 20 years or starving the people of Venezuela with sanctions. That's the United States. That's Britain. They're the ones who plunder. They're the ones who come and invade and refuse to leave and murder the local population. China engages with other countries based on a mutual understanding, based on mutual cooperation and respect. And I think I know which any rational person would prefer. These attempts by Britain, America, and Europe to isolate Iran and its allies on the world stage will ultimately prove to be futile. China and Iran, these are two ancient civilizations. They're not 300 years old. They're thousands of years old, with rich, vibrant cultures and histories. The two nations, they've enjoyed bilateral ties and friendship for millennia. The signing of this strategic partnership is just a modern manifestation and continuation of that very relationship. I think Iran's leader, Ali Khamenei, put it best in February when he said, "The post-US era has begun." Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the limelight.
Congressman Rick Hunt of California was the first House Democrat to speak out against President Joe Biden's request for $715 billion Pentagon budget for fiscal year 2022, an increase from the current $704 billion level approved under former President Donald Trump. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading Khanna criticizes Biden for proposing Pentagon budget law.